Well, friends, as always, it is good to have you here with us. My name is Mike Goldsworthy, and this is the Space for Faith podcast, where we're creating space for conversations that are reimagining the church for our current moment. And I know so many of you are going to be joining us next week. I can't wait to see you. We are going to be in Denver next week at this year's Post-Evangelical Collective. There are over 130 of you who are descending on Denver who are going to get to hang with a bunch of great folks. Like, I can't wait for you to get to be with the people who are going to be in that room. I think, you know, last year we created this thing almost by accident in some ways. And the beauty of it is who is in the room together, the kinds of conversations you're going to get to be in, the sense that you're not alone in the significant and important work that you're doing. And so I can't wait to see you. And in fact, the conversation we're going to have today is with Peter Choi. And Peter's going to be joining us next week. Peter's actually one of our speakers. What we're doing this year is we've got a few speakers giving short, like 15-minute talks that we're going to get into our table groups and sort of use that as a launch pad for some of the conversations that we'll have. So Peter will be sharing at the gathering. And Peter is the executive director at an organization called the Center for Faith and Justice. And they are partnering with us this year for this year's Post-Evangelical Collective. And I think you all are going to love them. I'm going to put information about them in the show notes, because I mentioned this towards the end of our interview, but I think pastors, church leaders, those of you that are leading these faith communities, I think a partnership with Faith and Justice Network could be incredibly beneficial for the work that you're doing. That there are some gaps that some of us are finding in our churches, not because we want those gaps to be there, but we just don't have the capacity to fill those in. And Faith and Justice can fill in some of those gaps for you, specifically around some space for people to be in community where they engage intellectually and with others around around thoughtful, like, resources, Christian authors, thought leaders around that sort of, like, they're doing incredible work. Anyways, he'll share much more about it. He'll articulate it better. But I can't wait to see you all in Denver on October 11th and 12th. Looking forward to seeing you soon. And until then, we will kick over to our interview here. Friends, we are here with Peter Choi, and Peter is the director of the Center for Faith and Justice. And in addition to that, you have a few things that you're doing, I've been learning, Peter. And so tell me if I'm off on all this, because I stole this from your bio on your website, but I know we don't always keep those updated.
Right.
So, Associate Professor of American Christianity, a member of the core doctoral faculty at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. You've taught the History of Christianity courses at Calvin, at the University of Notre Dame. And before that, you served as a pastor in Ann Arbor, Michigan. You're involved in all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, it's been a lot of different things in the background. An eclectic mix of things. But it's really good to be here with you, Mike. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, no, thanks for making time. And I love sort of that cross section that you have of the academy and of the church. And even I remember several years ago, I was really taken with a couple of works came out talking about the pastor reclaiming the vocation as a theologian. How that had been lost. And I know there's now been a whole sort of, there's a center around the Center for Pastor Theologians and all of that.
Yeah.
But it seems to me like you seem to embody a bit of that sort of cross-section of a true academic and also like a true pastor. Has that felt like a vocational intersection for you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, some of it was accidental, and then I think some of it, especially more recently, has been a little bit intentional. But I first felt my calling into ministry, and, you know, I kind of, like a lot of people, have had a love-hate relationship with the church, but mostly have, throughout my life, felt a sense of calling into the church. And I would say in the midst of doing ministry, as I followed the kinds of questions that were emerging for me and trying to pay attention, it led me at different points in more academic directions. I mean, we can talk a little bit more about this if you want, but in the midst of doing ministry amongst a lot of Asian Americans in that context, and a lot of emphasis on revival, which is actually not just Asian American, but North American evangelical culture, was asking questions like, well, what happens after revival? Because there's so much unhealth and damage control that has to take place after the mountaintop experiences. And that led me in the more academic direction of wanting to study the history of evangelicalism and the history of revivals. And so a combination of, you know, kind of trying to discern God's leading, but also some interests and questions that emerged along the way.
Huh. Is a emphasis on revival a normal part of not just Korean American, but Asian American Christian experience?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think in part because so many of the missionaries to Korea and different parts of Asia were products of the Great Awakening, and so there was very much a revival spirituality that characterized their spirituality, and so yeah. Absolutely. Huh.
I'm kind of curious about, like, even as you bring that up, one of the things that I've been seeing in some circles, I'm not as familiar with Asian American Christian circles, but in some circles, I've been seeing like a re-emphasis upon revival and a lot of like trying to define what revival is,
mm-hmm.
all that. I'm curious, like, what are the long-term implications of a movement or a church that's pretty focused on that? Does that seem to produce health over the long run? Does that seem to produce sort of short-lived experiences? What does that sort of do?
Yeah, I think it's a mixed bag. I mean, you know, I think we're going to talk about evangelicalism. And so that's a huge theme in the history of evangelicalism, right? I mean, depending on how you talk about it, if we agree that it's a movement that arose in the 18th century out of the first Great Awakening, it was the sense of trying to rediscover the faith of the Puritans, that project, that errand into the wilderness that had gone sort of dormant for a while. And so there was this huge movement in lots of different places, lots of different leaders, trying to recover a sense of fervency, a sense of devotion. And so that has very much been part of the evangelical tradition from the very get-go.
Hmm.
And then as you trace it, of course, there are going to be marks of health and then also marks of unhealth. And okay. It is very much a mixed bag. But I think recognizing that, because a lot of times I hear myself and lots of other spiritual leaders wanting revival, wanting that mountaintop experience. And I think having a sense of the fuller picture is really important, because we want that. We want the good stuff without recognizing there's a lot more. That goes along with it.
I want to get into this stuff, but I don't want to miss, like, I wanted to talk about you a little bit first, and for everyone to get to know you a little bit. So let's circle back to talking about evangelicalism and its roots.
Sure.
So you start studying some of this sort of stuff. You do your PhD work then. Do you remember, right? You do your PhD work with Mark Knoll.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So for folks who don't know who Mark Knoll is, I know him largely through being like the evangelical historian and through the book that, he's probably most known for The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind,
mm-hmm.
which everybody summarizes by saying The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind is that there is none.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So like, do you mind giving a little picture of Mark and why did you choose to pursue that work with him?
Yeah. Well, that was my first introduction to Mark, is that book. And that famous opening line, the scandal of the evangelical mind, is that there is not much of an evangelical mind. And so I was really drawn to his willingness to critique the tradition that he was part of. I really admired the courage and the rigor with which he did that work. And then Mark is one of the great historians of not just evangelicalism, but Christianity in our time. And so when I was thinking about studying the history of revivals, he was definitely at the top of any list. And then when I started studying at Notre Dame under Mark, I found him to be just a really, a very, not only an astute historian, but someone who really took his faith seriously and was just like that book, the Scandal book, would have indicated, very open to critiques, very open to questions and new avenues of doing research and writing around these traditions that sometimes get enshrined in a kind of a sacred plexiglass, and we're not allowed to critique it. And so he really encouraged and I think helped me to think outside the box in terms of how I might approach my study of my own faith tradition and then traditions that are adjacent to it.
Yeah. So were you pastoring when you started pursuing your PhD, or like how did those sort of line up?
Yeah, I was on the heels of 7 years of really intense campus ministry and church planting work. And frankly, I was kind of burned out. So that was part of it, and trying to pay attention to the longings of my heart, but also recognized that there were some of these longstanding questions that had been part of my vocational journey, even in seminary. And so it was sort of an opportunity to go back and pick up those threads and examine what it might lead to. And then, in the midst of, on the tail end of that experience of doing ministry in Ann Arbor, which, by the way, was a blast. So many fond memories, life-changing work that God did in my life. Switched gears and started a program in U.S. history, actually, studying 18th century colonial religion. Yeah.
And was that for you? Because you mentioned burnout there. Was that for you, like, I'm just kind of done doing work in the church and I need a different avenue to pursue? Like, yeah. What was spurring that on?
That's a good question. I think it was for me, because people ask me, like, hey, are you leaving ministry? And people were shocked and kind of offended, maybe even. And my response in the moment, and I think this was genuine and honest, was, no, I'm trying to understand how I can stay engaged in the work of ministry. I think it's just going to look different for a season. And there's kind of been this pendulum swing back and forth because, you know, of course, being in an academic program and graduating, there was sort of this natural impulse to move towards the academy. And I tried that for a number of years, but again, tried to pay attention and realized I can't see myself doing this for the rest of my life, just teaching and writing. And so there was a longing to be back in the church. And what I would say to people is I would love to find a way to do both, and especially not just both side by side, but both in a way where it feeds each other and look for ways to integrate those, that sense of various callings in my life.
Yeah. So that's out of Notre Dame. You go from Michigan to Notre Dame. Mm-hmm. And are you directly then, you're in San Francisco now, do you directly make your way over to San Francisco, or is there a little circuitous pass that takes you there?
Yeah, I went back to Grand Rapids for a couple of years. I started working at Calvin Seminary towards the end of my time at Notre Dame. So I was driving up a couple of times a month, maybe. And then for a year, we were there full time. I think it was my last year as I was finishing my dissertation. Moved up to Grand Rapids and taught History of Christianity courses and finished my dissertation. And then in the midst of doing that work, realized part of it was I grew up in Southern California, and for 16 long years, I had been looking for ways to make it back.
Where in Southern California are you from?
Like Pasadena. I've been moved around quite a bit, but mainly Pasadena.
Really? I don't think we talked about this before. Yeah. I grew up in La Quiñada.
Oh my goodness. Are you serious?
Yeah. For people who don't know, it's a little town right next to Pasadena.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's fun. That's another awesome conversation that we'll have to have.
Yeah.
What high school did you go to?
John Marshall in Pasadena.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's fun. I worked in La Quiñada. I actually worked at JPL as an academic part-time.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh, that's so fun.
So I drove
fun
to La Quiñada quite a bit.
That's so fun.
Yeah.
Sorry to have detoured you there.
No, not at all. Was there. And then the opportunity in San Francisco was really, you know, at the time it was City Church in San Francisco and a New Beacon House of Studies. And my wife, who grew up in Michigan and was very skeptical of a move to California, she was like, oh, this is exactly what you've been looking for and talking about. And they're already doing it. So It sounds like a great opportunity. And whereas I was kind of reluctant, it seemed like a big leap from, you know, having some sense of stability and a long-term trajectory to coming out into something that was, that felt a little bit more unknown. But it's been, and it has been a wild ride ever since, but it's been great to be back on the West Coast.
And how old are you when you're making this, like, a pretty significant vocational shift?
Yeah. I would say I thought about, when I was thinking about going back to graduate school, the thinking was, because it was already kind of late in life, at least sort of a lot of friends told me, you know, people don't really do this late in life. And so the thinking there was, maybe if I start now, I might finish before I turn 40.
Okay.
And then after that, after finishing, I think it was like right before I turned 40 that I finished the PhD. And then after that, I would say a lot of it has just felt like things in flux and trying to pay attention to my restless spirit. And some of it's frankly been a little bit mystical. Like, I don't really know where this is leading. But I feel peace about moving in this direction, or at least taking one step today.
Yeah. I was kind of asking because I was guessing that was the case. I've been reading a book recently called Range by David Epstein.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about, like, the subtitle of the book, I think, is something like Why Generalists Will Triumph in an Age of Specialization.
Mm-hmm.
But a chapter I was recently reading was he was making the case for kinds of people that make late vocational shifts actually having more significant, not only impact, but meaning and purpose in their life.
Wow.
Than people that sort of have an early on trajectory and just kind of keep at that one thing for a long period of time.
Okay, that's encouraging. That's I'm going to have to read that book.
It was super encouraging for me that I was like, this chapter was worth it.
Yeah, for you as well, because you've made some shifts.
Sure. Yeah. Okay, so you're at City Church in New Begin House of Studies, which then eventually becomes now the Faith and Justice Network.
It sort of, I mean, as of September 1, it has sort of become two different organizations.
Oh, okay.
So there's the Center for Church Innovation and then the Center for Faith and Justice. So it's kind of two different initiatives that we were running for the past number of years have kind of grown into two separate organizations.
Yeah, and so was this was like a side project that City Church starts, and maybe not really even a side project. Like, in my understanding of it from the outside, was like something they saw as integral to their calling and mission was to create this sort of like a training center.
Yeah.
Would that be
urban
contextual ministry?
Right, a theological study center that would try and work with the academy, and so established seminaries to offer, even like in the early days. What brought me out here was they were actually in the process of partnering with a seminary in the Midwest to do a track of sort of urban ministry, city ministry, an MDiv program for people who are sensing a call to the city.
Yeah.
So that was very much a part of the mission and the vision of the church, to say we feel like we want to be connected to something larger.
Yeah. I love that. I mean, I love like the innovative edge of that. I love the like heart of a church to try to bring in like a thoughtful, robust like teaching in the midst of actual like the work of ministry and figuring out ways to combine those.
Yeah.
Something that's rooted in a church. Like, that there's some really interesting things about that work that was going on.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Very much so.
All right. So I want to move into Faith and Justice Network also, but let's like circle back first to evangelicalism.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some of what, like, I've always used Bebbington's quadrilateral as kind of the quick go-to to define evangelicalism, which is, like, for folks that don't know, that it's these four sort of statements or agreements to say, like, evangelicals believe in the authority of the scriptures, believe in personal conversion, believe in atonement, the work of the cross,
yes,
and believe in, what's the fourth one? Like active works.
Yes, activism or voluntarism. It has to be embodied in your life somehow.
Right. And it sounds like you're even seeing some like differences with, maybe not different than that, but like not simply defining it by that. You talked about like a sort of fervor that's always been a part of evangelicalism.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like all four of those could be related to that revival of spirituality and the desire to rediscover and to practice a more authentic faith. And then I think that what I've discovered in my own studies and in my own sort of vocational journey is, well, of course, evangelicals would define themselves by these theological, I mean, you could almost call them sort of virtues, right? And it's become sort of a litmus test for folks to say, how are we going to define evangelicalism? Well, let's put these four markers out there. That wasn't how David Bevington, the historian, conceived of these four characteristics. Like he would say, they're not meant to be theological descriptors. They're meant to be historical descriptors. And so he was just trying to observe and to characterize features of evangelicals that he was observing in his study of history. And it's become, I think in some ways, it's frankly been hijacked into kind of a theological litmus test. But I think also, even with like even taking David Bevington at his word and trying to understand ways to trace the historical movement, it leaves out a lot. And so one of the things that I've tried to do, one sort of initial foray into this, was to say the four characteristics are maybe okay, but it seems incomplete. What if we added? Now here I was kind of trying to pay attention to David Hempton, who's a historian of Christianity at Harvard, and he was talking about in one of his books the civilizational and the cultural chauvinism of European Christians. And that really rang true for me. Like, yeah, the 18th century was an age of conversion, commerce, and conquest. And what's missing in the Bevington Quadrilateral are some of the more unsavory aspects of the times and the beliefs and the practices of evangelicals themselves. And so one of the ways I try to approach this is, what if we added chauvinism to the quadrilateral and made it a five-part thing, right? So it's conversionism, biblicism, crucicentrism, activism, and chauvinism. And it didn't go over very well with a lot of evangelicals.
I wouldn't imagine.
But it did spur some interesting conversations.
Yeah, I mean, talk to me a bit about that. Would you obviously, like, that was in your work and research, would you still today say, like, that's a significant part of evangelicalism, is at least some sort of, whether it's explicit or implicit, that chauvinism is a big part of it?
Oh, absolutely. And I would qualify it. So I mean, I've actually had conversations with David Bevington about this. We've talked, we've exchanged emails.
Do you call
we've
him
We've actually
Bebs?
Talked, excuse me?
Do you call him Bebs?
No. Hey, Bebs? No. Oh, if you ever met him, that would not be the,
no.
the first thought that comes to mind. But but he is sort of, I mean, I think trying to be very open. And he actually has said in public that what I'm trying to say about this is true of the 18th century. But if you move beyond into the 19th and 20th century to different parts of the world, it becomes less true. So it can't be true of evangelicalism as a whole. So okay. Now I have thoughts on that, but putting that aside, if we can actually agree that the 18th century was an age of cultural imperialism and that it's important to take into account these sort of features of cultural chauvinism and imperialism into account, I think that's a huge movement towards deeper understanding. And so, yeah, I think that's a promising path.
Yeah. How much of that is just in the waters of our churches too, without us realizing it? Like how much is that because it's a part of our history and it's been in our heritage? It is that even in churches that aren't, say, explicitly hierarchical?
Oh, yeah.
How much is that just still there?
It's baked into our DNA because if you believe... I mean, some of these things, like if I describe, I think evangelicals would say, of course, that's true. What's wrong with it? Right. And so if you believe that your understanding, expression, articulation of Christian faith is the truest and highest form of Christian faith, and that for someone to have salvation and to have a relationship with God, the truest and most pristine way of experiencing that is through evangelical faith. Now, evangelicals would say that seems to resonate, right? That seems pretty true to my experience. But think of like how that transfers into other areas of life. And I think part of the reason why there's so much strife in our world today is people saying or believing that their way of understanding truth is the highest form of truth. And there isn't a lot of humility, is there, in the kinds of conversations we have in faith circles. And so I think taking a step back to say, okay, some of this stuff, like the ways that we think and talk about our faith, actually has historical roots. And those historical roots have to do with imperial conquest and the enslavement of other human beings. And that was wrapped up with how we practiced and preached and embodied our faith. And so there's some work of disentangling that that is before us. I think that could be a helpful thing. It seems to me it's actually a very Christian way of thinking about repentance and reflecting on where you might have gone wrong, but it's still a really hard thing to do.
Yeah. I mean, it strikes me as you share those things that it should be so natural and normal in the church. And yeah, one of my experiences when I was leading the church is the things that that seem like they should be like, oh yeah, this is what a church does, or this is what Christians do, this is a natural outcome of following the way of Jesus, that there's actually a lot of pushback around sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I would assume just from the way that you're describing this now, like that comes out of a history of imperialism doesn't just simply critique itself. It wants to sort of power up and
yes,
show why it's right, right?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how you move beyond that.
Yeah. So my first book was on George Whitefield and the way that I tried to break into the field, because there's a lot of stuff that's been written about George Whitefield. He was the most famous evangelist of the 18th century, and was to look at him through his imperial context. So the title of the book is George Whitefield, Evangelist for God and Empire. And that just opened up so many, I think, different ways of trying to understand how it is that Whitefield was someone who was a product of empire, even as he tried to evangelize and preach the good news in the best ways that he knew how.
He was,
I believe he was sincere. But because he was a product of his times, there were ways in which he enacted his faith that were problematic. And that it would be good for us, it would behoove us to look back with the benefit of hindsight, with some historical perspective, and try to do some work analyzing and understanding the various layers there.
Yeah. Well, so it's interesting to me to think about the idea of a kind of faith movement that essentially sees itself as, we have figured out the best right way.
Yeah.
To see truth, to practice faith,
mm-hmm.
those sorts of things. Even I come out of, I don't recall if we talked about this before, I come out of the Restoration Movement,
yeah,
which essentially said, like, we're going to restore the Acts 2 church.
Right.
Like, we're going to go back to the beginning and we're going to restore those sorts of things. And so there was this sort of sense in that movement of churches, and still is in some spaces, of like, we're a more pure form, right, of this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that's striking to me about some of the spaces that I associate in now is I'm still seeing that happening, but through like some maybe more progressive lenses.
Yeah.
That it's like, well, we have the more pure, better form of what faith expression is supposed to look like. Like, I don't know how we avoid, like, how do we get out of that water?
I think part of it is realizing that it was always more complicated than we make it out to be.
Huh.
Because we look at these past periods and say, oh, like there was a time when people had it all figured out and we just lost that that time, right? So if we can trace our way back to Martin Luther or John Calvin or Jonathan Edwards, like if we can get to what they actually thought and believed, if we can restore that, to use your word, the word of your tradition, then we'll be in a better place. But to recognize that there was a lot of conflict and ferment and uncertainty in those times too. I mean, one of the things that I think is helpful is to remember, and Mark Noel is not the only person to say this. Lots of other scholars have talked about this. The difference between biblicism and sola scriptura. Biblicism is this idea that the Bible alone has authority for determining what your faith life ought to look like. Whereas sola scriptura is the belief or the conviction that the Bible is the final authority, but that there are a lot of secondary authorities that we ought to also pay attention to. And sometimes I think a natural extrapolation of that, not a lot of people would agree with this, but a natural extrapolation of that would be that as those secondary authorities proliferate and there are more voices that populate the body of those secondary authorities, how we think about and interpret scripture itself changes. And yes. So there's room for a lot of dialogue and conversation embedded in the historical tradition that we supposedly inherited, but we lose that nuance. And I think we oftentimes slip into the biblicism mode of it's the Bible alone. Nothing else matters in how we think about our theology and our spirituality. And we lose so much in that collapsing.
Yeah, that's so good. That's like, I feel like that's a much more thoughtful way of like something that I've said to folks is like what happened with the way that we read Genesis 1 and 2. That we had new information that caused us to ask new questions. And so it's not simply a matter of like, oh, you're reading it in some new way.
Yeah.
It's like, no, well, science has given us new information now.
Yes.
And so now we go back to Genesis 1 and 2 with new information and we ask it different questions than what we were asking it 400, 500 years ago.
Right, right.
And that keeps happening with all sorts of things.
Yes.
I mean, I feel like... astrophysics keeps messing me up in ways that, like, I feel like I go to the Griffith Park Observatory and the planetarium experience, and every time I sit in it, I have this existential crisis of, like, oh, here's what we know about black matter, and here's what we don't know, and here, like, and you just start thinking about, like, sort of the base of how the universe works. Anyways, I'll just say, like, we have so much new and other information, and it's not that like you are trying to bend the text into a different kind of worldview. Mm-hmm. It's that we simply have new things to bring to the text now than what was brought there before.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a capaciousness in the text itself. I mean, I think about the Psalter. Like Psalm 1 is, I can think back to a time when I would have loved Psalm 1. It's such a black and white, very clear delineation of the righteous and the wicked. And the righteous prosper and the wicked do not prosper, right? They are blown away like chaff in the wind. And sometimes we get stuck in Psalm 1, not remembering that there are other Psalters that say the exact opposite of Psalm 1, right?
Yeah.
Like Psalm 73 says, I nearly lost my foothold. I nearly slipped because I saw that the wicked were prospering. It's a direct contradiction of Psalm 1. And so the text is capacious enough to allow for that kind of conversation, that back and forth, that interrogation. But I think oftentimes we don't bring that lens into our reading of the text because it's not comfortable. It's very uncomfortable to think this Holy Scripture I'm reading may not be the final word on, like, this isolated text. It may not be the final word on how I think about my life today. And then that's not very comfortable.
Yeah. I'm forgetting the name of it now. Christian Smith's book on the scriptures was really important for me several years ago. And I remember he talked about the multivocality of the scriptures.
Yeah. The Bible made impossible. Yeah.
The Bible made impossible.
Yeah.
Like, it helped me to start putting a framework together for like how to make sense of those sorts of things.
Yeah.
And to allow the Bible to have a conversation within itself. And even things like, I was just having a conversation yesterday with somebody about, because these are the things that dorks talk about, like about the movement of circumcision in the scriptures and how the scriptures have a conversation about circumcision itself as something that begins in early pages as like a everlasting covenant that's going to happen forever. And then you end up with a Council of Jerusalem trying to decide like, is this actually something we should always do?
Right.
And then with Paul, then even like sort of like reinterpreting it and turning it into an analogy for baptism at one mm-hmm. point.
Yes.
That it like it shifts from like this is this thing that everyone has to do to like, well, is it really something we all have to do? Mm-hmm. Probably not. To like, okay, well, then let's reappropriate that into something that like we can use to talk about something else that's now part of our faith tradition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's, I mean, what you're talking about, lots of people would say that feels like the slippery slope, right?
Yeah.
And where does it end? And this is the problem and the danger of progressive thinking. But I would say like the entire notion of a slippery slope, if you think about it, assumes that you're at this mountaintop and that the only place you can go is down if you step away in any direction. And my encouragement to myself and to folks have been, well, what if you flip that metaphor? And if you thought of yourself in the valleys, you know, in a dark hole somewhere, and any step in any direction could be a life-giving step. And so there's kind of this hubris that says movement is dangerous. That's really, I think, a way of thinking that favors the privileged, people who benefit from the status quo. And if you begin to realize, I mean, I love that word multivocality that you just brought up, right? If you begin to realize or see the world through different perspectives and listen to multiple different voices in different parts, in different positions, different positionalities, in different social locations, it can't help, well, I think it can't help but create a sense of empathy and humility and curiosity to listen and learn.
Hmm. It's so good. Like I get like fired up just kind of hearing you talk about stuff like that. Like it's so, it feels like such a more interesting, healthy, and life-giving way to engage with scriptures, to approach it with curiosity and humility and to want to listen to a multitude of voices,
yes.
both like now and historically, like,
yeah.
You know, I often say that I grew up in a tradition that essentially was like, we started reading the Bible in 1950. And like, that's, you know, we would, of course, never have said that, but it was practically how we work things out.
Right.
And then to discover there's this rich, like, tradition of people wrestling with the same text. And then to discover, and there's also people in different social locations around the world now and historically that have been reading those same texts. And that are seeing them differently. And the thing that I would often hear from folks as I would like sort of push into some of that was like, well, which one of them is the right way to read it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think it's hard for us to have a sort of a posture that says like, well, maybe all of them, or maybe mm-hmm. like they're all contributing some way to something that's richer. And it's not about getting it this one right way. Is that
right?
Is that something that you would be getting at?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's so much freedom in realizing that the weight of the world does not rest on the correctness of my interpretation of things, of these texts and of these traditions. To recognize and to be with, like, to actually live out this this realization that I could be wrong about this, and, you know, the world would not fall apart. My salvation would not be at risk. That I could be wrong and the world would still go on and God would still love me and God would still love the world. Like there's so much freedom in that. And how sad, how burdensome, how oppressive that we hinge so much on the correctness of our very particular and short-sighted interpretation and perspective.
Okay, so once we move into this sort of thinking, though, do the scriptures have any kind of authority anymore? And if they do, what kind of authority do they have?
Yeah. What I think scripture continues to be a source of a guidance, and I would even use the word, I feel comfortable with the word authority, because there's something, when you have this sort of collectivist appreciation for the authority of scripture, you realize, oh, the scriptures talk, I mean, one part of the text talks back to another part of the text. There's disagreement and there's a back and forth and the text itself is in travail. Other scholars have said this. Then there's a freedom and recognition that there's a God who lives, who operates above this text, outside of this text. Yes, there's ways in which the people, the writers and the authors of Scripture have been inspired by the Holy Spirit. But, you know, you don't mistake the Bible for God, right? There isn't this kind of, I mean, some people talk about bibliolatry, confusing the Bible for God. And if you can make that distinction, which I think is a very, it's a distinction that Christians have made for a long time, many different kinds of Christians have made for a long time, then I think there is a freedom and an openness to keeping it messy.
I like that a lot. One of the things I wanted to talk to you about, and I feel like we've been getting into it a good bit here, is the idea of like how you maintain a rooted faith while you're also reimagining that faith in our current moment. So this feels like a bit of like, how do we treat the Bible in a way that recognizes that?
Yeah.
Are there other, in the work that you're doing, are you recognizing other sorts of ways to live into that kind of tension?
Yeah. Well, I think even to just to interrogate or unpack that language a little bit, like the desire to be rooted, to realize like faith has never been about being rooted in one place, right? That faith has always been about this kind of dynamism and this movement of peoples. And there is a way in which you are rooted in community, you are rooted in relationship with God, but it's a paradoxical kind of being rooted. Even Psalm 1 talks about being transplanted on different soil. And so if that's the norm, so if our normative expectations are, things aren't always going to stay the same because they never have. There's, change has been part of life, and we celebrate change, and we appreciate, and it's uncomfortable, and we don't have to enjoy all of it. Like there's a lot of aspects of change in my life that I don't enjoy or appreciate. But if we begin to accept that this is a part of life, it's an unavoidable part of life. I think that helps to instill some humility and enables us to discover richer aspects of our faith.
That's a good word. That's helpful. So if we were to use words like rooted, it's more about being rooted in relationships, which are dynamic, as opposed to being rooted in something that's static.
Yes, that's a really good way of putting it.
Okay, I want to hear a bit about the Faith and Justice Network and the work that you all are doing, because I have been so intrigued by you all. I mean, just watching you from afar, the folks that you're bringing in to lecture and be a part of some of the teaching and cohorts that you do are phenomenal, are the kinds of people that like I want to be hearing from and learning from. I'm so like, it's such high caliber kinds of stuff. So, tell us a little bit about like, what is the Faith and Justice Network? What's the work that you all are doing?
Yeah. So, I mean, the simplest way to talk about it is that it's an online learning community that anyone can join. There's a membership cost, but, you know, we have scholarships, et cetera. So everyone is welcome to join. And it's for people who are asking big questions and looking for a more expansive way of practicing Christian faith. And maybe even ways to think about Christian faith in ways that are much more open and open-ended than the kind of categories that we've imposed on it. And then what we actually do is every month there's a theme or a unit, and we have, I mean, the flow of it is basically an author that talks about the book that we're reading. And it's a lot of fun because we get to invite people into our community that we're already reading, that we want to be in conversation with. And then there's also, based on our work in theological education and partnership with seminaries, there's an academic track option, but it's not for everyone. Like, I think often, most years, it's less than 10% of the participants who are doing the work for academic credit. And most folks are just in there to learn and to be in conversation with other folks. We have participants from, last I checked, around 30 different U.S. states and all over the world who are just part of this conversation and open to learning and realizing that faith is a journey and that we need to be in community. Now, can you do this in your local church? Yes, but we just happen to be a community where lots of people are finding us because they have been displaced from their local worshiping communities for a variety of reasons. And so we have lots of folks who are coming from some kind of post-evangelical space. We have lots of people also in the mainline church space. And then people who are kind of spiritually homeless and wandering, but enjoy the opportunity to connect and to be in conversation and relationship.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that the work that you all are doing is so helpful for people. Like the work of like asking questions of your faith, unpacking what you've been handed, going back and re-interrogating some of the stuff that's been passed down to you in your history. People are doing that some by kind of reading on their own, thinking about things on their own, maybe watching some YouTube videos of somebody or whatever. But to have a robust community of people to process it with, to have some thoughtful leading voices to process that with, like, feels like a really healthy, helpful way of engaging in those things rather than going about it on your own.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I would say in addition to the community, which I think is the primary sort of benefit or privilege that we enjoy just being in relationship with one another, is the curation work that that happens. Because a lot of the things that we're finding, or that we ourselves have, you know, you can find it on YouTube if you know what to look for, what to search for. But the curation and the integration with other kinds of similar texts, or maybe even texts that might disagree and spur on a deeper conversation, I think that's the part that's really fun, is to recognize there's so much stuff out there. It can be really bewildering for folks to try and sort out all the different sources and all the different voices you want to listen to and learn from. And so having that curation to some degree kind of already set enables us to have the energy to engage in the actual conversation and working out of the topics and the questions together.
Yeah. And we were just talking a little bit before we started recording, you're doing this also for churches that are looking for something like this that could be a part of their church life, whether that's a kind of theological education or maybe a spiritual formation space. What does it look like for churches to do it, not just individuals?
Yeah. Well, yeah. What we tell churches is, hey, we help to provide and curate the curriculum, and then you come alongside of us and provide the contextualized leadership for your people. And I experienced the benefits of this myself as a pastor at City Church in San Francisco, where we have these monthly conversations in our community. And the wonderful thing about that is I don't have to do all the work preparing the content, because that's already happened. And I just get to go and enjoy the conversation with the people and connect and to hear the ways that they are wrestling and the kinds of questions that are welling up for them. And so I think this is a great, it can be a great resource for churches. It's kind of a new thing. We've had lots of pastors in our community who are trying to figure out how this, what this might look like in their church communities. And I think we just don't have the categories and the muscle memory to plug and play this kind of thing. And so we're learning together. But yes, if churches or pastors are listening, we'd love to be in conversation with you about how we can work together collaboratively around some of the work that's already happening in our midst.
Yeah, I would love that. I'm stoked you all are going to be with us in Denver, so you can meet some of the pastors that will be a part of that as well. I'm glad for them to get to know you. I was also wondering, as you were sharing that, is this something that, like, not only could a local church do, but is it the kind of thing that, like, say there's a group of people who find themselves church homeless in an area and they've got friends that they're, would they gather together a group of friends and say, like, we're going to go through this together and we're going to be the in-person sort of component together?
Oh, yeah, I would love that. We would love for something like that to happen. We already have cohorts. And so what I failed to mention earlier is that we have sort of this network community where there are all these resources available, but then there are these cohorts led by cohort leaders who are, they're meeting typically twice a month over a Zoom call. Some of the cohorts might meet face-to-face if there are more, if there are people in kind of the local community. But yes, it's absolutely the kind of thing that, you know, if there's a group of people out there that don't want to do this work alone, but they already have a community, that would be a lovely way to use our resources.
Yeah, there's so many potential connection points, I feel like, for folks that you all are putting together some really great, not just content, but other folks that are going through it with you. So you're putting together great content and great community. And it just feels like there's so many potential connection points for individuals and for churches and communities to be able to take advantage of.
Yeah. I mean, we were just talking about this before we started the recording, but like, I just love the fact that we're living in a time where people are asking questions and have the boldness now to express those questions in ways that maybe they may not have had in the past. And people are just finding each other, right?
Yeah.
And there's something really beautiful about this new way of engaging one another in spiritual work. In some ways, it's been happening, you know, throughout, as long as human beings have been around, this has been happening. But I think we're seeing new ways of people actually being able to connect. I mean, we felt this and saw this over the pandemic, which is still with us, but in many ways, you know, the revolution of Zoom meetings. And so I think we're just trying to pay attention and enjoy what's possible now in ways that they weren't before.
Yeah. When I was telling you, like, one of the things I love about you all is there's a lot of space for all of those questions, but it's not just a place of let's just critique and tear things apart. Mm-hmm. But it's also like people who are doing new creative things that are building towards something. Yeah. And for me, in the place that I'm at, like, I think it's really helpful to have spaces where people can feel comfortable tearing things apart and being able to ask those questions. Like, we need that kind of space. But that just kind of, if that's all that there is, it kind of ends in a kind of nihilism that doesn't feel like beneficial for humanity. It just kind of is an end in and of itself that doesn't move anywhere. And so to have something that both creates that safe space, but it's also like critiquing by creating as well. Like, just feels so healthy and helpful from where I sit.
Yeah. I mean, well, to go back to that word multivocality, I think we need a multivocality, not only of words, but of creative and artistic expression and making new things in the world. And so I just love this idea of, hey, I could be surprised by people in my community thinking up new ways of expressing their faith, of practicing their faith. And I get to just, you know, we get to learn together because we're in relationship together.
Hmm. So good. Well, hey, I would love to ask you one last question as we wrap up here. I'm thinking about some of the post-evangelical pastors who listen to this, and it has become, there's a lot of critique of the evangelical church going on right now, and rightly so. Like, there's been a lot that has been uncovered for sort of in a way that's accessible to a lot more people.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot that's been coming to the surface. And so rightly so, there's been a lot of significant critique of that. I think it can be really easy to sit in a place where you have moved into post-evangelicalism and to be able to look at that and to kind of throw stuff back at it. I'm kind of curious for us to be in a space where we're also looking in at ourselves and saying, like, okay, as this thing is happening, what do we need to be aware of? Mm. How do we not just become another thing of what we're critiquing and moving out of?
Yeah.
So I would love to, like, if you have a word or a thought or a suggestion for folks that are kind of living in that space, that are creating in that space, what would be something that you would offer?
Yeah. That's a great question. Thank you for that. Because I think that really is, in some ways, the question of our day. It's not the only question, but it's one of the big questions of our day is, how do we do this work together and move along, if not in, exactly in tandem, at least move in somewhat the same direction, right? And I think it's just having openness to new words, new expressions. I think about, we're going to be reading Cole Arthur Riley's book, This Year Flesh, next month. And she talks a lot about her spirituality as a tool of survival, which frankly is a very different way of thinking and talking about spirituality than lots of white Christians. Amongst white Christians, I think the kind of language that's more common is a spirituality of flourishing. But if you think about spirituality as a tool of survival and recognize, hey, some people are doing this work because they're just trying to make it day to day. that looks very different than a person of privilege who enjoys lots of stability in their life, who are just looking for a pathway to flourishing. And the biggest problem of their day is boredom, which is, again, I don't want to speak down to that. That's sure. That's a very valid thing for that person, or, you know, depending on, and sometimes that's the biggest struggle of my day and the privilege I enjoy. But what if we really began to understand, to listen to somebody who says, hey, I'm doing this work and I'm just barely making it today. What does that look like? And how do we, it's recognize we can't put ourselves in their shoes, but how do we show up for that relationship? It's going to look very different. And so having that openness and the humility and the curiosity to be able to say, there's a lot of things in the ways that in my toolkit that I'm going to have to put aside, not forever, but to try and imagine life and spirituality for people in very different social locations.
Ugh. I get like teary, like hearing you describe stuff like that. That's thank you for sharing that. What a gift. Dr. Peter Choi, genuinely such a gift to have you hanging out here with me today. Thanks for making time.
Yeah, thanks so much, Mike. This has been a lot of fun, and I really enjoy the work that you're doing in the world and the things that you're making in the world. And I look forward to being in Denver.
Yeah, I can't wait. I can't wait for us to hang out in person. And Faith and Justice. So, let's make sure we point people to where to go. Faithjustice.net.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Faithjustice.net on the internet. Is there anywhere else we should be pointing people towards?
Yeah, we're also, we're on Facebook and Instagram, and you'll see links there, but I think the it's faithjustice.net. So like Instagram/faithjustice.net is
okay.
Great.
And we'll put all that in the show notes as well, folks, to make it easily accessible. I genuinely so grateful for the work that you're doing and so glad that we got to hang out today. Thanks for making time.
Yeah. Thank you, Mike.